Chapter 12. Café Blanc. As she walked from the Louvre, she seemed to sense some articulated structure shifting to accommodate her course through the city. The waiter would be merely a part of the thing, one limb, a delicate probe or palp. The whole would be larger, much larger. How could she have imagined that it would be possible to live, to move in the unnatural field of Viereck's wealth without suffering distortion? Viereck had taken her up in all her misery and had rotated her through the monstrous, invisible stresses of his money. And she had been changed. Of course, she thought, of course. It moves around me constantly, watchful and invisible. The vast and subtle mechanism of Herr Viereck's surveillance. Eventually she found herself on the pavement below the terrace of the Blanc. It seemed as good a place as any. A month before she would have avoided it. She'd spent too many evenings with Alan there. Now, feeling that she had been freed, she decided to begin the process of rediscovering her own Paris by choosing a table at the Blanc. She took one near a side screen. She asked a waiter for a cognac and shivered, watching the Paris traffic flow past, perpetual river of steel and glass, while all around her at other tables, strangers ate and smiled, drank and argued, said bitter goodbyes, or swore private fealties to an afternoon's feeling. But, she smiled, she was a part of it all. Something in her was waking from a long and stifled sleep, brought back into the light in the instant she'd fully opened her eyes to Alan's viciousness and her own desperate need to continue loving him. But that need was fading, even as she sat here. The shabbiness of his lies somehow had broken the chains of her depression. She could see no logic to it because she had known in some part of herself, and long before the business with Nas, exactly what it was that Alan did in the world. And that had made no difference to her love. In the face of this new feeling, however, she would forego logic. It was enough to be here, alive, at a table in the Blanc, and to imagine all around her the intricate machine that she now knew Viereck had deployed. Ironies, she thought, seeing the young waiter from Napoleon Court step up onto the terrace. He wore the dark trousers he had worked in, but the apron had been replaced with a blue windbreaker. Dark hair fell across his forehead in a smooth wing. He came toward her, smiling, confident, knowing that she wouldn't run. There was something in her then that wanted very badly to run, but she knew that she wouldn't. Irony, she told herself. As I luxuriate in the discovery that I am no special sponge for sorrow, but merely another fallible animal in the stone maze of a city, I come simultaneously to see that I am the focus of some vast device fueled by an obscure desire. My name is Baku, he said, pulling out the white-painted iron chair opposite her own. You were the child, the boy in the park.
A long time ago, yes,
he said.
Tanyor has preserved the image of my childhood. I have been thinking about your Tanyor.
She didn't look at him, but at the passing cars, cooling her eyes in the flow of traffic, the colors of polycarbon and painted steel.
A man like Viereck is incapable of divesting himself of his wealth. His money has a life of its own, perhaps a will of its own. He implied as much when we met. You are a philosopher. I'm a tool, Paco. I'm the most recent tip for a very old machine in the hands of a very old man who wishes to penetrate something and has so far failed to do so. Your employer fumbles through 1,000 tools and somehow chooses me. You are a poet as well. She laughed, taking her eyes from the traffic. He was grinning, his mouth bracketed in deep vertical grooves. While I walked here, I imagined a structure, a machine so large that I am incapable of seeing it. A machine that surrounds me, anticipating my every step.
And you are an egotist as well.
Am I?
Perhaps not. Certainly you are observed. We watch, and it is well that we do. Your friend in the brasserie, we watch him as well. Unfortunately, we've been unable to determine where he obtained the hologram he showed you. Very likely, he already had it when he began to phone your friend's number. Someone got to him, do you understand? Someone has put him in your way. Don't you think that this is most intriguing? Doesn't it pique the philosopher in you?
Yes, I suppose it does. I took the advice you gave me in the brasserie and agreed to his price.
Then he will double it.
Paco smiled. Which is of no importance to me, as you pointed out. He has agreed to contact me tomorrow. I assume that you can arrange the delivery of money. He asked for cash.
Cash, he rolled his eyes. How risque. But yes, I can. And I know the details as well. We were monitoring the conversation. Not difficult, as he was helpful enough to broadcast it himself from a bead microphone. We were anxious to learn who that broadcast was intended for, but we doubt he knows that himself.
It was unlike him, she said, frowning, to excuse himself to break off that way before he had made his demands. He fancies he has a flair for the dramatic moment.
He had no choice, Paco said. We engineered what he took to be a failure of the bead's power source. It required a trip to the Ohm then. He said very nasty things about you, alone in the cubicle.
She gestured to her empty glass as a waiter passed. I still find it difficult to see my part in this, my value. To Virik, I mean.
Don't ask me. You are the philosopher here. I merely execute Tenor's orders, to the best of my ability.
Would you like a brandy, Paco, or perhaps some coffee?
The French, he said with great conviction, know nothing about coffee.